Hey everyone, welcome to Oncology Decoded. We have a very interesting episode for you today. We're going to discuss AI and oncology. Of course, I'm here with my partner, Manoj Bhupathi, and it's great that he's going to be the one leading the ship today because he actually has a master's in biomedical informatics, you know, so he doesn't get to use that very often. I'm the one who's naive here, so he's going to get to teach us everything. And what we're going to talk about is the use of AI in oncology. And, you know, I'll just start and say, we're just dabbling. I'm just a regular oncologist in this space, learning how to use it to implement my tools. Before we get going, Manoj, what do you think? AI and oncology, any big overarching themes that we need to think about?
Yeah, no, I'm really excited for this talk. We've never done something like this. We've always talked about breaking down science and breaking down, you know, therapies and things like that. That's kind of what we've always done. And here we're really talking about tools of how we can use better diagnosis, better prognostics, and things. And I think it's really exciting time in oncology and in medicine in general. I think we're going to see huge practice pattern changes as well as much better outcomes for patients as we're able to leverage this technology. The thing though is I don't know if a lot of people know the different facets of AI, right? I think when we think about AI, it's kind of like I'm using AI. But what does that actually mean? Any thoughts on that? Like, have you thought about it? Like, what does it mean for you when you say AI, right? Like, what does it mean for you?
Short answer and long answer. So the short answer, we're all going to be out of jobs in 20 years, and it means that magic makes everything work better. But the long answer, no, is, you know, I think a lot of us understand that are read on the subject, and I wouldn't say that I'm read on the subject, but I want to dabble in it, is that most of what we're using today are based on language models, right? LLMs. I think it's language learning models, or is it learning language models? I don't know. Maybe you'll say, he's shaking his head, yes, but I'm not sure which one. Which one is it?
Language learning models.
I got it right the first time. Is LLMs, which is basically ways.
It's large language models.
God, so I was totally wrong. So I don't even know what the acronyms stand for, but these LLMs, what they can do is they can help, you know, do predictive text and help us teach what's going on. And what we've done at our practice, I know with many community and academic practices across the country, is adopt these LLMs into our note writing, right? So that's the first, I think, foray of my understanding is be able to have my microphone or my phone in the room with a patient, is hearing and filtering our dialogue to synthesize a really pretty darn good clinically relevant note. So that was our first understanding. You go back to like ChatGPT and Claude and Grok, all these other things that are out there. And those are also, my understanding is those are also LLMs, and that's how they also work. But Manoj, tell me I'm right or wrong, because I've already been wrong once in the last minute.
No, but I think that's the reason why I was saying. So LLM is large language models, right? So basically it's looking at large data sets and kind of compiling things together. But there's many different facets of AI when you think about AI, right? So there's computer vision. So computer vision is really thinking about looking at imaging. So you're looking at your CT scans, your MRIs, or looking at pathology slides or cystoscopy images or whichever way you want to do it. Then there's machine learning and radiomics. So that's really looking at like identifying patterns or clinical variables that you or I may not easily recognize, right? Like, you know, back in the day, we used to do changes in acute lymphocyte count. Does it mean anything? Like, we used to see those studies, or absolute neutrophil count. Does it correlate with anything? These are things that you can use machine learning to find much easier patterns for. Digital pathology, right? So you're basically looking at detecting tumor, detecting grades of cancer. You're looking at prognostic information just from the H&E slides when you're able to train the model to understand what patterns to look for. Then you have predictive AI and multimodal AI, right? So predictive AI is looking at more recurrences. What is the likelihood that the cancer is going to come back? You know, this is the question that we face every day, because our patients are going to come in and they're going to say, well, I'm going to do this therapy. What is the likelihood that this is going to work or not going to work? What is the likelihood that it's going to work for X amount of time? And those are all predictive AI tools that you can look at trying to figure out response rates. Multimodal AI is looking at genomics. So looking at our next-gen sequencing testing that we're all doing now in all of our GU cancers, but also all in every oncology patient. But then it's also combining your laboratory data, the treatments that you've gotten before, and your genetic data and then kind of synthesizing it all together to give you an answer as this is what you should look at. Then what you're alluding to earlier is more your generative AI or your large language models, which is your LLM. And those are your documentation, chart summary, clinical trial matching. And eventually they can come to the decision support because you're using these other facets within that to get to that next step. So there's many different facets of AI that are really, really important when you're trying to think about it. I am going to make one comment that you're not going to lose your job anytime soon. And I actually think it's actually going to increase the job force. I don't think it's actually going to cut down on the job force. There was a study that actually looked at this that said that the fear was that AI is going to be a replacement, but you actually need a lot of touch points to make sure that your agents are working the way that they're supposed to in order to figure out what's happening. And you need to have that human interaction to double check. So it's going to go from where I foresee it is that we're actually going to be at the next level or next order of thinking, not the basic menial tasks. So the menial tasks are going to be taken away and they're going to be synthesizing the information for you. And that next decision support is where your expertise is going to come in saying, well, I have all of this. We've already done this and the data shows this. Based on this characteristic, this is your next best step. And that's where the gap in AI really actually is. But can we do some of these therapies and things without the actual invasive things, right? So for example, prostate cancer, that's probably our biggest predictor and strongest section. And I'm choosing GU cancer because that's our area of expertise. And you and I have actually published a paper on using AI in imaging about a year and a half ago as well. So if you think about prostate cancer, we already use PI-RADS, right? So we use PI-RADS to help us figure out what is the likelihood that somebody has prostate cancer, right? You've seen that on reports that tell you radiologists look at it and they'll help identify segment, assign risk, and potentially unnecessary biopsies, right? If you have a PI-RADS 2, you're not going to do a biopsy. But if you have a PI-RADS 5, you know this is prostate cancer and you're going to do a biopsy. That's AI tools that you're already using on an everyday basis. Now, the more interesting things is actually the AI and pathology, right? So we know Gleason scores. Gleason scores are subjective, right? You have two different pathologists that look at it and they get the score independently and you get a composite, right? But if you train a model and you train the model very effectively, can you get better results? Because we only go off of experience, right? Like if you and I were to look at a pathology slide today and we see, oh yeah, I remember this is what a Gleason pattern 3 looks like. And then this is what a Gleason pattern 5 looks like. But we don't do it again for 3 months, 6 months. We're relying on what we think it may look like. And we may not remember it completely accurately. But if you train a model to remember what those characteristics look like, that model's never going to forget. And so will we get better risk assessment on Gleason scores if you have an AI telling you, yeah, this is a Gleason 4+3 and not a 3+4? And clinically, you know what kind of implication that has in terms of treatment decisions.
I think it goes beyond that. So first of all, let's divide one side of this podcast as a Kool-Aid drinker when it comes to AI. And the other podcast is, I'm a big believer AI is going to work really well, but I'm still scared I'm going to lose my job. I just want to make that very clear to everyone listening today, but that's okay. I think you're right. I think so. The LLMs, I'm using that. My partners are using that. My colleagues across the country, many of them are using that. And it is very clearly an effective strategy for us to get rid of some of the documentation burden of our jobs, right? We go home earlier. We don't have the same notes we have to write. If we didn't write the note the day of, that data is captured and it can be spit right back out onto that note. And there's a bunch of companies in this space and a bunch of EMRs working on adopting this technology. And I think that is not only here to stay, but it's only going to get better with time as these models continue to learn. Then you move into, I guess, what we're going to call computer vision. I like that term. It makes it sound like we're on a Marvel movie. And all of a sudden, we're drilling down into imaging and pathology. And I think I see the benefits and I think I can take it a step forward, right? Because I think let's talk about digital path and prostate cancer, because we have guideline directed indications to use digital path AI tools in prostate cancer, whether it be alongside some of the more kind of molecular data sets like Decipher and those types of tools, or whether they're independent, right? Yeah, you can actually...
Well, Decipher is actually using AI already as well.
They're using AI. This is why you're the king. Artera is the other one that's out there. Obviously, we've seen a lot of data sets from Artera. And I don't know that they're just looking at Gleason score. We actually don't know. And I remember Daniel Spratt giving this conversation about this Artera data set from the podium at one of these major conferences and saying, it's a bit of a black box, right? You're putting these path slides into the machine. They're getting scanned in. And then maybe they're using things outside of Gleason score. We don't actually know what everything is being picked up. Could they be looking at tumor cells and proximity to vessels? Could they be looking at how well these tumor cells look like they're adhering to each other versus separating from each other? So I think there's a whole can of worms that we haven't explored about why an AI model may or may not be more beneficial than traditional pathology. And I think it's really complex and it's really interesting.
Yeah. So to that point, though, you know, we've always seen discrepancies in tests, right? And if you order a test, let's use genomic testing, right? If we order a Caris versus a Foundation versus a Guardant, you'll see different results sometimes. You'll see that genetic, some will pick up one marker versus another pick up another marker versus another pick up a different marker. You'll see those differences. What's going to happen in these AI tools is very similar. You already alluded to it, right? Artera AI and Decipher. You look at Artera AI, how they do their modeling is very different than how Decipher does their AI, right? So Decipher is using machine learning and looking at genomic classification. Artera AI is actually using the histopathology slides. So that's actually reading the H&E biopsy slides and clinical variables. So they're actually looking at very different methods in order to help you understand the risk assessment. Now, the next challenge we're going to have is, what are you going to do? Which test is more reliable and which AI tool is the better way to go? Which is why I don't think you're ever going to lose your job. And you're going to have to make that decision as to what is the better modality of doing this, right? Your AI model is only going to tell you the mathematical computation and results based on those, but it can't make a clinical judgment. The point being is that just like how we've always talked about, you pick your test and then you run with it, or you have to pick your therapy based on what you're looking at clinically, you have to look at your AI in a very similar manner. You have to understand what is the AI test actually looking at in order to figure out if that's the test you want to use or not use. And very similarly, that's going to happen across the board in imaging, right? Like if you look at PET PSMA imaging.
Let's not get to imaging just yet. I want to get to imaging. Sorry. But I clearly am out of my depth here. I don't even know what my test is apparently that I'm sending. So when should I send these tests in prostate cancer? When are you sending an Artera or Decipher or one of those other types of prognostic tools?
Yeah, so I'm generally using Artera more than Decipher. And the Artera I'm using because Artera gives me a little bit more information for clinically relevant to status because I can omit ADT and it gives you that information.
And Decipher, so what population is that you're using it in? It's like an NCCN intermediate low or all intermediate risk or out?
I'm generally using it in all intermediate risk. One, because this is looking, the intermediate risk for favorable and unfavorable is really dependent on that Gleason score, right? And so this is re-verifying, is that Gleason score really real? Because you're going back to that subjective information, right? So versus me looking at, you know, pathologists just telling me it's 3+4 versus a 4+3, that's really what's making your distinction between the intermediate risk. And so I'm using Artera AI for that. So for those patients that are planning on getting radiotherapy, do you have to give them ADT? Who are those patients that you can omit ADT? Historically, we've always given them ADT based on their Gleason score. If they have 4+3 Gleason score, they would get ADT. They would get radiotherapy, and they would get anywhere from 6 months to 18 months of ADT with radiotherapy, depending on what you're seeing. But Artera AI can help you figure out, do you really need ADT or not? So
I think that's great. Isn't there a role for Artera though in deciding whether or not you need abiraterone in high risk as well? Are you using it for that population?
Absolutely. But you know, then you have to look at the STAMPEDE data, right? So for the high risk patients as well. And so, you know, that's also been helpful. I tend to use that as more clinical features. I don't believe Artera or Decipher can tell you about the additional use of an ARPI in that high-risk population at this point. We may get there, but I don't think it does. It's really in that intermediate-risk population that I tend to use it. And I do use it even in the favorable, like low-risk 3+3 patients, especially if they're younger, African-American, family history, but genomic testing is negative, and you're debating, do we want to do any intervention? Then I'll use Artera to help me figure out what is a true risk here. So I'll use it in that group of patients as well.
So you're using it in low and intermediate risk to, one, decide, is active surveillance reasonable for this patient that may be at elevated risk compared to the normal population in that Gleason 6 role? And then in that intermediate low, intermediate high risk, Gleason 7, 3 plus 4, 4 plus 3, there's some PSA features, you're using on whether or not to give ADT in conjunction with radiotherapy. And I think that's great. In the high risk, you seem less likely to use it to make the decision of, we know they're getting radiotherapy, we know they're getting ADT, whether or not we should leverage apraterone. We have the Stampede, that's, you know, that high Gleason 8 or greater. PSA was actually greater than 40 in that population, though the NCCN very high risk has it down, has it lower. I think it's at 20. And then some other risk factors of pathologic risk factors and some other risk factors went into that initial Stampede score. But you don't find it as useful in that setting, because that's more, you think of a clinical decision-making setting. And I'll tell you, I think that's reasonable. I don't know why I think that's reasonable, except for the fact that I go to a lot of these meetings and dinners with my urology colleagues. And I will tell you, not just in my market, but in other markets, there is some hesitation about how often that those AI tools say you don't need to give abiraterone in those high-risk populations. Now, maybe that's accurate. Maybe we are overtraining too many people in that very high-risk population. Maybe it's inaccurate, but it's interesting to see that the hesitation I'm hearing in some of these meetings is similar to the way you're practicing and how those align. So I think that's maybe a good thing. Maybe it's not, but it's interesting nonetheless. Okay. I think that was super helpful. If you want to jump into imaging, why don't you guide me on a journey? Because you're right, I was a co-author on that paper with you, but I know that you were much more the brains than me on that. I went through some cases and you know, annotated some things. So why don't you share us a little bit more about where imaging and AI is going?
Yeah, so imaging and AI, right? So again, this is all subjective, right? Everybody looks at imaging, and then you and I are not radiologists, but we look at imaging. We look at imaging with our patients. We'll pull it up and we'll say, yeah, you know, this looks stable to me, because we'll pull up the calipers on the screen and we'll measure some, and then we'll follow the RECIST criteria and then say, yeah, this looks similar, so I think your disease is the same. And then we'll see new spots and then say, well, yeah, this also looks, this doesn't count based on the size and what we're looking at. And then we'll say, either you have stable disease or we're going to, here's progression and we're going to make your change. Now, and the SUV metrics, like, you know, especially on the PET scans, like how bright is something, right? And is, you know, and I may be wrong in saying this, but I think there's some subjectivity to how the SUV measurements are done. Like when I talk to radiology colleagues, some will tell me, yeah, that seems about right, but maybe I would have called it like this. Or yes, that seems about right, or maybe I would not have called it like this. And if I knew a little bit more about the clinical history, I would have changed my answer a little bit. And I think there's, you know, when you have a scan that is a yes-no modality, your AI tools can be very powerful. When you take the subjectivity out of it, and then you really look at your previous imaging and your current imaging, and you're overlaying them or just comparing them, it's much easier to understand, is there true spots? Is there a true change in SUV? Is there a decrease, and how much of a decrease? All of that is mathematical, right? There's no subjectivity to it. And so when you take that out, your assessment of your disease state becomes much more accurate. So then that can feed directly into your therapy standpoint, right? Is this the time to really change or not? So the paper that you and I published a year and a half ago now is looking at those, right? Looking at the degree of change and the understanding lesion by lesion. Now, that was a different tool that we were using, and understanding the volumetric changes in SUV calculations and sizes, and it gives you these, and it identifies exactly which lesions progressing versus not progressing, because we've had this whole new entity of oligometastatic disease or oligoprogressive disease in prostate cancer, but we're also looking at in other areas, in which case then, can you use your radiation for that as opposed to changing your systemic therapy as we've always done, right? So the imaging modalities, I think if you are able to streamline them and then use your AI tools for that, you will get much better outcomes. Now, what's more exciting to me is what we were talking about earlier, which is AI cystoscopies. I think that's really cool. So basically what you're doing is you're using real live AI while you're actually doing the procedure of a cystoscopy. Because while you're doing the cystoscopic evaluation, your AI can read that pathology in real time and tell you, hey, this is actually an area of concern versus a visual like, oh yeah, I can see this and this looks off. But if you have epithelium that just looks slightly red, and it may not be concerning, but that may be the area where they develop a recurrent non-muscle invasive cancer down the line. Now your AI can help you pick that up way earlier because it's learned what the characteristics under the microscope would look like and what it can predict to look like as well. So I think that's really cool when you're using those kind of tools. So to combine the visionary tool of AI with like the imaging tool of AI, I think we'll really be able to advance some of our diagnostics much, 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 much faster.
No, look, that was an amazing overview. And I think overall, I am more excited than hesitant, which is always a good thing, right? Now, when you start talking about some of these imaging features, what you can see is the spatial changes over time, the intensity changes over time, and you might see early mild progression. And the one thing I think we have to be hesitant about as a field is to say, well, some of these AI changes that are indicating early progression does not necessarily mean a switch of therapy is the right decision. And the reason for that is you take the break off the cancer, layer in another therapy that may be less effective, right? And all of a sudden we've maybe harmed a patient. So I do think we need to clinically validate and collect data prospectively so that we know how best to use these incredible tools that are coming. Because I do see that as a downside. I do think like oligometastatic progression, as you mentioned, is a great use case. Leave them on the therapy, radiate a single nodule that seems to be getting, you know, potentially being the not node of resistance to come. So I think it's really exciting. I think it's really compelling. And I just need to throw out that little caution that I think as a field of oncology, we need to make sure that we find out how to prospectively run trials to validate some of these new data and new technology. And when it comes to the cystoscopy, I think it's the same thing, right? I mean, this is really cool. This is really great. I'd never heard about this. So thank you for teaching me about this. I'm going to do some research on this. But the same thing comes. Like, what could over-treatment of a lesion that's going to become an NMIBC, what could that do to potentially harm a patient when that potential non-muscle recurrent can be treated with BCG 6 years from now? So I think these are the things that we always struggle with oncology. Is early intervention helpful, or do we run into a lead time bias and actually not impact survival? So I think we'll learn. I think the next 10 years is going to be kind of chaotic. Fine.
I think you just learned why you would have a job. So.
Well, maybe I will have one. You're right. It's my kids who won't. So we'll change my fear. How about that? You've pushed off my fear cliff. I don't have anything else to add. But no, is anything else we should say about AI?
I think there's a lot more we can talk about in AI. I think what's really exciting is actually integrating all of it, right? So like, think about a vision, and I'm going to leave it with this final thought. Think about a vision where you have a patient that you've been treating for 5 years, right? 5-6 years on prostate cancer, and they've progressed through a number of lines. They've been on therapy for years, and you know, you've known them since the original localized disease, and then you've known them since first-line metastatic, and then for second-line castration-resistant disease, though that's not the right term anymore, but you've known them for that entirety. You have hundreds and hundreds of pages of data, and you have to go back and look at every single one of them. Imagine a scenario where your agent understands your thought process of what information is needed for you to make a really good clinical decision for a patient who has progressive castration-resistant disease and is able to provide you from history with very quick response rates that, hey, this is what the patient was diagnosed with. This was the Gleason score. This is what you gave him first time. This is what you gave him the second time. This is what their genetic mutations look like, all in a synopsis of 7 bullet points. And then tells you, based on their genomic profile and the clinical trial evidence that we've seen where you've had patients that were treated with Pluvicto after this, or they've received chemotherapy after this, or something like that, and then tells you, consider these options. That would be fantastic, because then you can really just have a discussion.
And I think we're kind of getting there, right? And this is an amazing future, and things like open evidence and stuff, you can actually type in lab values and data and things, and open evidence will, you know, not only curate the literature around it, but it will also spout out some recommendations as well. So it's only going to get better with time. I agree. I think that's a fantastic tool. And I know it's helped some of us who, you know, who view ourselves as specialists, but still when it comes to the hospital call service, have to see everything to double check and remember, okay, wait, what was actually in the guidelines for DVT thrombosis, things that, you know, I don't like to think about generally on my day job, but sometimes on my weekend job, every 2 or 3 months I have to. So I think it is very helpful there. And I think, you know, it's not just going to be open evidence in the future. It's going to be a lot of different AI companies coming into this space, not just, and some of them will probably integrate directly into some of our EMRs in the future, I imagine as well.
And I have one more thing I want to say, and then I will stop. Please. I promise it's my last one. So imagine, so how much time does your like staff spend on going and getting records? I mean, I know mine spends a lot of time in terms of going out and getting information. Imagine your AI agent can log in and get the information for you, and your staff goes into our central system. Like we use Corio in Colorado, right? Like my AI agent can see what's needed and then go get it and then put it back. Like, that's amazing. It saves a lot of time. And the patients don't have to worry about it, right?
It seems like a win. But again, we're replacing somebody, Manoj. You just replaced someone. So there you go. Fear is real.
I don't think so. Because you still have to be able to log in, right? You have to have a user, like you have to be able to have a human interaction in order to log in with the system. You have to be able to do something, right? And you need to make sure that it's all matching. Because the future is going to be agents talking to agents. That's really what's going to happen, is that my agent is going to talk to your agent, and then they're going to come up with something, and it's going to go back to you and me in order to figure out, is this really the right thing or not? That's where I see the next step going.
Look, I love it. I think for those of you that listened on your podcast feed, go to the website, watch the video. Manoj has never looked this happy in his life. I know this guy a very long time. He's never smiled this much for 30 consecutive minutes. So AI is the future. He's converted me to a believer with his raw enthusiasm. So I don't know. What else should we say besides?
This is... No, I'm really excited for the future. But...
All right. Well, good. Well, follow us at Oncology Decoded on your socials. Subscribe. Give us 5 stars on your podcast feed. We don't normally say that, but please do it. It helps us get noticed. And also feel free to email us at Oncology Decoded. Or gosh, what is it? podcast.oncologydecoded.com. I'm mixing it up today. And we look forward to seeing you next time.